Talk Shoes. Recorded live.
Troublemaker, I'm not going to answer that question. I will save that for another time, but my answer is no. Yeshua, descended from Judah. Okay. Bill and I actually devoted a program to that, you know, a brief discussion. And we could certainly devote a very, very long discussion to that, you know, discussing the pros and cons of the Joseph Scepter theory versus the...
Well,
theory.
Right, and just throw all their arguments out the window. Well, it's very clear from Hebrews and Revelation that Christ descended from the tribe of Judah, period.
Right.
And that there's no way you could twist either of those scriptures, except that the Ephraim Scepter people are also Paul bashers. So what they do is they throw Hebrews in the garbage, and they twist Revelation 5:5.
Yeah.
They're idiots.
But we
They're clowns.
We did a brief discussion of that, but we could probably devote actually a couple of shows to the subject and really discuss it in detail.
Yeah, we probably could.
But for me, the clincher is that Tamar is not a Canaanite. Tamar is, in fact, she's a descendant of Shem.
Well, I think that the Joseph Scepter people are the Ephraim Scepter people. They're the Canaanites, mostly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, Er and Onam were evil, but Tamar was not. Okay. Yeah.
I challenged them to a debate. I challenged Scott Vaught and Charles Vaught, all them. I'll roll with them anytime they want.
Yeah. There's a lot of problems with the Joseph Scepter theory. But getting into tonight's theme, and we're going to pick up in Daniel chapter 4, verse 15. But first, I just want to say, I want to make a couple quick announcements here. Tomorrow I'll be on with Sword Brethren at his 5 o'clock Eastern show. We're going to be discussing current events plus John chapter 18. And then tomorrow night, the Yahweh's Covenant people will be continuing our study in the book of Acts. And on Sunday, Russ Walker, who is actually Troublemaker in the in the chat room here, we're going to be talking a little bit about Mormonism. And what's wrong with Mormonism? Where did they go wrong? Did they ever have anything right? Okay.
Well, he's heating you up for the program on Sunday, Ben, ain't he?
Yeah.
Right. I think you'll be talking about Judah and Joseph.
Oh, okay. Well, then, that'll be later, right? At 5 o'clock or 9 o'clock Eastern on Sunday. You and Sword Brethren?
Well, we're talking about 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern. We're doing Dr. Kurt Wiebe, Germany and the Jewish Problem, Part 3.
Oh, okay.
And we'll be talking about Jewish immorality and Jewish corruption in Germany in the Weimar Republic.
Okay. And then for the balance of the Voice of Christian Israel on Sunday, we'll be talking about the Fort Hood Massacre, what really is going on there. You know, they're having 10 suicides per month at Fort Hood, folks, which means, that's where I took advanced infantry training, so I know that base very well. And that's what they're covering up. They're covering up the fact that the morale in the military is an all-time low because the soldiers don't believe in these wars that we're fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan, okay? And that's what's really going on. And the media is just making all this stuff up about this Arab guy or Muslim guy who probably...
I think there's a lot of other problems in the first place.
Oh, yeah.
To have a Muslim psychiatrist in the army... That shows there's a problem. I mean, he should be in an army, maybe in Kuwait or something.
Right. That's almost as bad as having a Jewish psychologist in the army. I'm sure there's plenty of them, okay? But before we even get into Daniel 4:15, I just want to say, I've been thinking about this a lot, and it's really dawning on me that Christian identity is so far ahead of all of these other denominations in terms of the fact that we study and discuss biblical history and how it pertains to understanding the Bible. And I could say, without any fear of contradiction whatsoever, that the Catholics, the Protestants, the Evangelicals, the Holy Rollers, the Pentecostals, probably even the Seventh-day Adventists, and all these other denominations, none of them pay any attention to Bible history. Each denomination may have a scholar or two who devotes time to, you know, digging up history and talking about archaeological discoveries that have happened recently and how they pertain to the Bible. But
and he puts it right together with the work of that Jesuit Jew Ribera and blows it all out the window.
Yeah, yeah. And so what we're seeing here, and this is totally Paul's prophecy fulfilled of the great apostasy occurring right before our very eyes. None of these denominations have any interest in Bible history. None of them. Absolutely none. I mean, have you found any denominations that show any interest in this?
No. If they're interested in Bible history, their major thrust is to prove that the kingdom of David and Solomon and exists.
Right.
And then from there, they only carry that through to the Jews anyway. So that's right. They want to prove the Bible, the Old Testament, is true. And then on the other side of the coin, they want to throw the Old Testament out because they're New Testament Christians.
Right, exactly.
They're so full of conflict and contradiction, it's unreal.
Yeah, and if they discuss Old Testament history at all, it's to try to verify that the Jews are Judah or Israel.
And Old Testament history actually verifies that the Jews are Esau. So.
That's right, exactly. So that's why they're not interested in Bible history, because it totally disproves their theology.
They're generally interested in fighting with the biblical minimalists. And most Christians concentrate their arguments towards the biblical minimalists.
What do you mean by minimalist here?
The biblical minimalist, there's Israel Finkelstein. I even hate to say that word.
Right.
And there's a Dutch scholar. I forget his name. It's forgettable anyway.
Okay, right.
There's half a dozen renowned scholars or so that sign on with this Israel Finkelstein and this one Dutch scholar whose name is lost on me.
Right.
And they believe that the old kingdom was invented basically by Ezra and Nehemiah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, when they needed an identity in Canaan land and created one for themselves. That's the biblical minimalists. David's a myth. Solomon never existed. Hiram never existed. It goes down to that the Jews basically become a kingdom under Ezra and Nehemiah in the 6th century.
Right.
And that's when the Bible starts.
Okay.
And everything before that is just sheer invention.
That's
basically the gist of the biblical minimalist.
Yeah. Right. But obviously the Judeo-Christian scholarship does everything it can to support and prop up Jewish fables, okay, including the fable that the Jews are Judah. Okay. And, with the language of the Old Testament being corrupted by the identification between Judah and Jewry, which it never should have been done at all in the Old Testament, because the Judahites never referred to themselves as Jews, certainly not with the definition we have today of a Jew being a multiracial Talmudic religion, okay, that bears no resemblance either ethnically or theologically to what the Judahites practiced in the Old Testament, okay? And so it's all fables. It's all fables, and so the minimalists probably tell fewer fables.
Right, and they dismiss all the ancient inscriptions, and they systematically dismiss them.
Yeah. Well,
like the Black Obelisk that talks about Shalmaneser taking out 200,000 Israelites, that's just a fable.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, he was bragging.
Yeah.
It was right. Really 200 Israelites. He was bragging.
Right, yeah. So, but I'd say that all the archaeological finds that we've been coming across in recent years, especially since things like astroarchaeology, computer graphics, computer imaging, they're finding confirmation of Old Testament history left and right, okay? And every time they find something, it verifies what the Bible says. That's just the bottom line, okay? So these minimalists don't have a leg to stand on. It's obviously nonsense coming from both atheists and other Jews. Okay. So I just want to bring that out, folks, that these modern denominations are only interested in maintaining their orthodox beliefs, and they're not interested in discovering any history because they're afraid that if they discover real history, their orthodox beliefs may get shattered. They're terribly afraid of that. And consequently, they have no interest in biblical history whatsoever, okay? All right, let's get back into Daniel chapter 4. And I'm going to start at verse 15 because we discussed this last time. We just want to bring this issue up about the stump, the tree that was cut and the stump that was left. Actually, let me back up to verse 14. He cried aloud and said thus, hew down the tree and cut off its branches, shake off its leaves and scatter its fruit. Let the beasts get away from under it and the fowls from its branches. So it's talking here about the kingdom of Babylon being destroyed. And there's some very interesting aspects of the history of Babylon after its destruction, namely that it became so barren that it became uninhabited, totally uninhabited.
Well, right, but Babylon isn't, you know, I even repeat it a lot too, but Babylon was never actually destroyed. It really fell into disuse.
Right, right.
It took several centuries from this time, but,
yeah.
I mean, Alexander the Great died there, but it's the city, they actually ceased to use it.
Right, right. Yeah, it suffered several military defeats. But the it never suffered, you know, a catastrophic defeat that destroyed the outlying provinces and other big cities besides Babylon. That all took some time. Yeah, that all kind of. But
well, in 539, Cyrus basically walked into Babylon.
Right, exactly, and we'll be discussing that later on. I don't know if we'll get to it today. Maybe we will. Okay, so now verse 15. Nevertheless, leave the stump of its roots in the earth, even with a band of iron and brass, in the tender grass of the field, and let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let his portion be with the beasts of the grass of the earth. And so this banding of the stump. Now remember, the tree was cut down, and all that was left now is the stump, and then these bands that are placed around the stump are designed to prevent the stump from drying out and to allow the roots to live on so that at a future time a shoot, a new tree could come up off the stump. And then why don't you talk again about the meaning of the iron and brass here in this verse, Bill?
Well, I think, and a lot of people would argue with me about this because I know what Alexander Hislop wrote, and I know what they say about the Catholic religion. And it is true that most of the Catholic ritual and pomp and circumstance has ancient roots back to Mesopotamia.
Right.
But it had... you know, for 2,000 years before Christ, that these Eastern pagan religions were coming west,
right.
And that's simply because the people came from there,
right?
You know, and brought them with them.
Sure.
I believe that the Greek and Roman religious systems were the band of and political systems were the band of iron and the band of brass.
Okay, iron is Rome and brass is Greece.
And Daniel's vision of the beast in chapter 2.
Right, right. Okay, very good.
And they basically suppressed the rule of the Babylonian Shetar, the Babylonian Talmud,
right,
over Christendom for 2,500 years.
Right.
And from the time that the Jews finally, I mean, it took several centuries from the Satan was let out of the pit, and that's a different conversation, but we had it a couple of times over the past few months.
Mm-hmm.
Satan was let out of the pit during the Enlightenment, and that's around the same time that the Catholic Church put its imprimatur on interest and changed the definition of usury.
Okay.
And a short while later, the Protestant churches did the same thing, and it took several centuries from that point for the Jews to gain control of our society.
Mm-hmm.
But and they did that in stages too.
Right.
Because they gained control of England with the Bank of England, basically that began that process.
Yeah.
And they gained control of France with the French Revolution. But they gained control of America in 1913.
Right.
And they gained control of Kaiser Wilhelm's Germany and Tsarist Russia by 1917 and 1918.
Right, right, yeah.
Hitler was a glitch that stood in their way.
Right.
You know, he stood in their path and he failed.
Yes.
But
yeah,
they basically had control over all of Christendom since after World War I.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, well, that brings us to verse 16, and that's where we first come across the term seven times, at least in the book of Daniel. So let me read it here. Let this heart be changed from a man's, and let a beast's heart be given to him, and let seven times pass over him. Now, seven times mean 7 years for Nebuchadnezzar himself, but the seven times also is a reference to the kingdom of Babylon, because this verse follows the verse that talks about the stump, and that this stump, we're definitely being told that this stump called Babylon is going to be reborn at some future time. And in the next verse, we're given this expression seven times, okay? So let me back up to Leviticus 26, where it talks about the seven times prophecy concerning the punishment of the 10 northern tribes, okay? So Leviticus 26, verse 18, let me back up to 17. And I will set my face against you, and you shall be slain before your enemies. They that hate you shall reign over you, and isn't that happening to us today? And you shall flee when none pursue you. Okay, we're having all kind of imaginary enemies that we're afraid of, because the Jews are making up these enemies, like we really have a problem with Islam, as if the Jews hadn't imported them into our nations, we really wouldn't be having half the problems we do right now with Islam. Verse 18.
Right, and if we didn't let them get control of the oil wells and a few other things.
Right, exactly.
The Jews let that happen too.
Yeah. So we're having all these imaginary enemies where none should exist. Verse 18. And if you will not yet for all this hearken to me, then I will punish you seven times more for your sins. And then seven times more for your sins. And in verse 21, and if you walk contrary to me and will not hearken to me, I will bring seven times more plagues upon you according to your sins. Okay, that's the second time. Third time, then will I also walk contrary to you and will punish you yet seven times for your sins. Fourth time, back up to verse 27. And if you will not for all this hearken to me but walk contrary to me, then I will walk contrary to you also in fury, and I, even I, will chastise you seven times for your sins. Okay? So we're told at least four times here by Yahweh that he is going to chastise us seven times for our sins. Okay? Especially if we don't obey his laws. And, of course, we haven't been obeying his laws. So when we talk about the seven times prophecy of the captivity of the 10 northern tribes, that began in the year 745 B.C. when Tiglath-Pileser invaded Palestine, so-called, and he took the eastern half of the tribe of Manasseh first. That was in the year 745 B.C., and those were taken captive and placed into Media, what we know today as southern, that portion just south of the Caucasus Mountains. Okay.
Well, they were. That was the main concentration of them, but they were actually spread out in a few
right.
other places.
Right.
I'd like to talk also. You know, Numbers 24:22.
Okay.
It's the it's actually Balaam, the prophet that tried to prophesy against Israel, speaking.
Uh-huh.
And it says, "Out of Jacob shall come he that shall have dominion." And it says that the Kenites shall be wasted. And speaking to Israel, it says, until Asher carry thee away captive. And that's the first place it's spoken that the Assyrians would take the Israelites away. That's
uh-huh.
in Numbers chapter 24. And it goes hand in hand with the seven times of Leviticus, I believe.
Right. Yes. Oh, absolutely. No doubt about it.
But even before the Israelites were in the settled into the land of Canaan, it's spoken about them being taken away captive.
Right, right. But I'd just like to document the fact that the half-tribe of Manasseh was taken captive. This is from Putnam's Dictionary of Events, copyright 1927, page 6. It states, quote, 745, accession of Tiglath-Pileser III of Assyria, who wages war against Chaldea, Syria, and the kingdom of Israel. And that document that did occur in the year 745 B.C., and that was the starting date of the captivity of all 12 tribes. Now, if we
right, because actually Shalmaneser left a monument saying that he took 200,000 people in 46 fenced cities
uh-huh.
of Judah.
Right.
Troublemaker.
Yeah, right.
of Judah.
Right. That was
and put them with the Israelites.
Yes, and he put them with the Israelites. Yes, exactly. So that all 12 tribes were eventually put together in, not necessarily as one group, but in the same general vicinity under the auspices of the Assyrian Empire. Okay? So now seven times means seven times 360, for various reasons. We have the 1260 years a couple times in Daniel. We have 1260 years a couple times in Revelation. And these are referred to as 3.5 times. Okay? So you add 3.5 plus 3.5, you get 7 times, and that equals 2,520 years.
And we'll see that also. We will see in when we do Daniel chapter 7, we'll have to do it in concert with Revelation chapter 13.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And we'll see that the first beast is dated by, I believe, by Daniel, by John. And that's the succession of empires from Daniel chapter 2, which are drawn in, another picture of those is drawn in Daniel chapter 7. And the second beast is dated by Daniel, and that's 1,260 years.
Okay, right. So we have several examples of 3.5 times, and then if we add these 3.5 times together, we get 2,520 years. So if with the starting date being 745 B.C., you add 2,520, the resulting date is 1776 A.D., which is the regathering of the 12 tribes of Israel.
Right, and there's other dates for other tribes.
Right.
It's evident that they weren't all taken out of at the same time.
Right, exactly. But that was the starting date of the deportations, okay? And then the starting date of the birth of this country was July 4th, 1776, okay? And then since there's no year zero, if somebody's doing the math, they're going to get 1775. But since there's no year zero, you have to add one to when you cross from B.C. to A.D. And so I just want to document that the 7 times notion is very important in Scripture, and it is a prophetic notion, 7 times, okay? So let me get back into the book of Daniel, and I went too far here. I took my pen. Have you got your Bible in front of you?
I have a software Bible in front of me.
Oh, okay. You got Daniel 18 in front of you? I lost my mark, and I'm flipping through the page.
Well, I have Daniel. The text of Daniel in front of me also.
Okay. We left off at, well, here, I got it now.
Well, I thought we were going to take from 4:14, but that's okay. Well, we just discussed the stump. Before we move on to 18, I would only like to talk about the watchers of verse 17.
Okay.
And I've mentioned this before, but Hesiod's a Greek poet from the 7th century B.C. And in his work, the works and days, it's called.
Okay.
Around line 250, it says this: "For upon the bounteous earth Zeus has thrice 10,000 spirits, watchers of mortal men." And Daniel's calling these angels watchers.
Right.
And I'm just trying to say that the Greeks and Daniel had the same religion. Mm-hmm. That this Jewish thing is not the Jews have perverted the Old Testament to try to make it appear unique to them.
Right, of course.
But all the white, the original Judah was white, and all the white tribes of the area had the same basic core beliefs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then the northern areas, and for a time, too, the house of Judah had become paganized as well. But that ended after the return from the Babylonian captivity when Ezra and Nehemiah instituted a golden age, which was prophesied in Jeremiah that it would be a golden age, and they kicked out all the Mamzers, and they refused to allow the non-Israelites to even help in the rebuilding of Jerusalem, okay, namely the Samaritans and others, okay. So they actually had a pure-blooded kingdom going with the return from the Babylonian captivity, okay, not as most Jews teach and most Judeo-Christians falsely believe, namely that's when they began race mixing. That's not true. They kicked the Mamzers out. And so you can say that was a golden age, and even down through the Maccabean period, the Judahites, the house of Judah, maintained a pure racial descent, and they fought wars against invading armies to keep their racial descent pure. Okay.
Right, against the Seleucids, actually.
Right.
I'd like to talk about a year for a day in prophecy.
Okay.
That a year is a day in prophecy is evident from, first from Numbers 14:34, after the number of days which ye searched the land, even 40 days each day for a year.
Right.
And Ezekiel 4:6, I have appointed thee each day for a year. In other words, a day in prophecy is representative of a year.
Year in time, yes.
And Daniel 70 weeks works out prophecy, which we'll talk about in a few weeks here when we get to Daniel chapter 9.
Right.
That 70 weeks is 490 days.
Mm-hmm.
And it
right.
fits that pattern perfectly.
Yes, yes. Yeah, so we have numerous examples of days, prophetic days equaling exact years, okay? And so there's really no doubt about this, okay? And only the atheists and people who don't care about the Bible at all have any problem with this. I think all Bible scholars really accept this as fact. However, we always have differing interpretations, and when we get to Daniel 70 weeks, we'll find out how strange the interpretations are of the Judeo-Christians, okay? All right, anything more on verses 14?
No, I'm good now.
Okay, so let me read verse 17. We just quoted the seven times in verse 16. Verse 17, this matter is by the decree of the watchers, as you just mentioned, and the demand by the word of the holy ones to the intent that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomsoever he will, and sets up over it the basest of men. Okay? And that's what we've got today, folks. If you want to, if this word is Adam or Enosh, I haven't looked it up, whichever this one is. Verse 18. This dream I, King Nebuchadnezzar, have seen. Now you, O Belteshazzar, which is Daniel's name given to him by Nebuchadnezzar, declare the interpretation thereof, for as much as all the wise men of my kingdom are not able to make known to me the interpretation, but you are able, for the spirit of the holy gods is in you. And it's plural here. Verse 19, then Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, was astonished for 1 hour, and his thoughts troubled him. The king spoke and said, Belteshazzar, let not the dream or the interpretation thereof trouble you. Belteshazzar answered and said, my lord, the dream be to them that hate you, and the interpretation thereof to your enemies. The tree that you saw, which grew and was strong, whose height reached to the heaven, and the sight thereof to all the earth. And, of course, we're talking about the known world to them. Verse 21, whose leaves were fair, and the fruit thereof much, and in it was meat for all, under which the beasts of the field dwell, and upon whose branches the fowls of the heaven had their habitation. It is you, O king, that are grown and become strong, for your greatness is grown and reaches to heaven, and your dominion to the end of the earth. Any comments up to this verse here?
Just that, you know, this punishment, this proposed punishment of the book of Nezar is, it seems to be like a type or a model for the punishment of Israel.
Okay.
Because Nebuchadnezzar told him that he'd be sure to get the realm, the throne again, that his kingdom would be assured to him
yes.
after the seven times.
Uh-huh.
And when we cover Daniel 7, we'll see that promise also stands of Israel.
Right.
That after the seven times, the saints of the Most High would receive the kingdom.
Right, right. And then we find that literally for King Nebuchadnezzar, when he was driven insane for 7 years, his personal kingdom was restored to him at the end of that time. Okay, so there's a dual meaning here.
I believe so was ours, but now there's
yes.
other prophecies in play today.
Yeah, right. Okay, so verse 23, and whereas the king saw a watcher and a holy one coming down from heaven and saying, hew the tree down and destroy it, yet leave the stump of the roots thereof in the earth, and we've discussed this at length already, what the stump means. Again, even with a band of iron and brass in the tender grass of the field, and let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let his portion be with the beasts of the field, till 7 times pass over him. Okay, so we're given the 7 times message a second time, and we'll get it a third time as well. Verse 24, this is the interpretation, O king, and this is the decree of the Most High, which has come upon my lord the king, that they shall drive you from men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and they shall make you to eat grass as oxen, and they shall wet you with the dew of heaven, and 7 times shall pass over you, till you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men, and gives it to whomsoever he will. So let me just stop right there. I want to go back to this talk about they shall drive you from men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. Now, it's true that the Babylonian banking system as it was established in old-fashioned Babylon, where they had the clay tablets, which were actually receipts for goods sold, okay, and took the place. In fact, I don't know if they actually had gold coins in circulation at the same time. They probably did.
It's very arguable about the use of coins. It can go back and forth.
Yes. Okay.
And actually, some coins were recently discovered in Egypt that actually pushes the date back for the use of actual stamped coins.
Right. Okay. But from all the research I've done, it tells us that these clay tablets, which were receipts, began circulating as money.
Well, yeah, and they're extremely old.
Yes.
The clay tablets with the cylinder seal and the idea of making a contract like that probably goes back to at least 2500 BC.
Right, right.
And coins, the earliest, off the top of my head, the earliest use of coins that I know of, aside from the recent discoveries in Egypt, is probably the 8th century BC in Lydia.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right. So that's not too long. So less than 1,000 BC, whereas these clay tablets and receipts, this business of using receipts as circulating medium in exchange for goods, or, you know, as exchangeable for goods, is a very, very old technique, very, very old. And it was actually duplicated when the Rothschilds and probably other Jewish bankers had started doing this as well in medieval times, and maybe post-medieval times, because you mentioned the Enlightenment. But at a certain point in history, when people started owning more and more gold, and they had to deposit their gold rather than carry it around because gold is very heavy, okay?
Yeah, that actually, that actual system started, I believe, in France in the 12 or 1300s.
Okay. And so what they did was they deposited their gold with a banker, okay? The banker gave them a receipt either for the entire amount or for smaller amounts, adding up to the total amount of gold that they had on deposit in that bank, okay? So these paper notes, these are called promissory notes. These promissory notes promised the bearer a certain amount of gold. Okay, so whoever possessed that piece of paper could take it to that bank and get that gold and take possession of the gold. All right, but what the bankers found out was that nobody was coming back to claim the gold. All right, so the gold would just sit in the bank with very rare exceptions. And the people would start trading the promissory notes as currency.
And the Jews discovered the fractional reserve banking
system. That's when they invented the fractional reserve banking system. I'm convinced that they did it with these clay tablets, too.
Which today they've legalized.
Right, and they've legalized it today. That's right. So what they did, to be very specific for those who are not familiar with this story, what they did was they started printing their own counterfeit promissory notes, knowing that people rarely actually came back to demand the gold. So they were able to print 9 times as much promissory notes, that is counterfeit money, spend it into circulation for their own purposes, and increase the money supply by 9 times.
And actually, I read this in the Wall Street Journal about 10 years ago. The international standard today for fractional reserve banking is 9.5 times.
Okay. So, you know, in fact, so that's what fractional reserve banking means, folks. It means that they only have to hold 10%, 9 or 10% of the actual gold, you know, in deposit, and they can actually spend 9 times as much money, even though that's all counterfeit.
Right, but that only counts for certain large commercial banks, I think.
Right.
It's only special types of banks that are allowed to do that.
That's right.
Your average banker, your neighborhood banker at the savings and loan down the corner, he's not going to know much about that.
No, he doesn't do that. No. But it's these Jewish-owned banks, these international banks that do that. The Federal Reserve does that. Okay?
Well, they have certain licenses for themselves to enable them to do that.
Right. But basically what the fractional reserve means is that you have to keep so much cash on hand as a reserve, because this is the amount of cash. Now, we're talking just about cash. Now we're not talking even about gold anymore. because none of these banks have gold anymore. They just have cash, okay? So all they have to do is keep cash on hand now in case there's a run on the bank or people, you know, they figure that 10% of the people always come back to get cash out of the bank, you know, and use cash for purchases and what have you. And so they never have to have more than 10% of the actual cash on hand that, you know, that the bank says they have, okay? And the rest is kept, they just keep lending the rest out and earning interest on it. So it's a scam. I mean, it's even worse than the fractional reserve banknotes, because at least those banknotes, you could go back and get some gold. But today, if you take your Federal Reserve note to a bank and want some real money, all it is, Troublemaker says it's more like 1%. That's really what it is. They only keep about 1% of the cash on hand. The rest is all checks and bookkeeping entries on a computer. It's all phony money. So your fractional reserve system, you're actually talking about where the banks simply create money, spend it into circulation, and they call it cash. They call it money. But it's all one big scam. And it was started with these clay tablets back in Babylon. Okay? I just want to make that connection so people understand that Mystery Babylon today is this Jewish banking system.
That's but if we didn't go into debt, they really wouldn't be able to create that money.
Of course not. What's a confidence game?
Because we create that money for them.
That's right.
We empower them to create that money every time we take out a loan.
That's right. Exactly right. Every time we borrow money for a mortgage, and, you know, people don't understand how the system works. That's why it's called Mystery Babylon. We're all suckers. Yeah, Babel Bucks. Very good, RP. Babel Bucks. And the world is being run by Babel Bucks. And it's a phony economic system, totally run by it's counterfeiting, legalized. As you mentioned earlier, this system has been legalized.
Well, if the government printed dollars instead of bonds,
yes,
then we at least wouldn't have the interest payments.
Right. I think it was who was the inventor? Invented Edison. He said, if the government can issue a bond, it can issue a dollar.
Absolutely.
Okay. A debt-free dollar. He meant by that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the Jews don't want to hear that.
Of course
not. And that's why, you know, we've always had the Jews around us. We've always had the pagan religious elements around us.
Yeah.
But in 1916, 1917 was 2,520 years after the binding of the stump.
Right.
It was 2,520 years after Nebuchadnezzar took the throne.
Okay. Yes.
And
we'll get to that. Yeah.
From that time, the Jews have ruled our world.
That's right. No doubt. There's no doubt.
Not only economically, but the legal system. Case law came in under the Woodrow Wilson administration that started to grow and became the de facto legal system. It's straight out of the Talmud. The commercial laws, the Shitar, straight out of the Talmud.
Yeah.
They were around for 2,000 years, but when the Federal Reserve was instituted, we've been bound by those laws.
Yeah, right.
Ever since.
Right, right. So this seven times prophecy is very significant for us today because it has come to pass. This Babylonian money system, fractional reserve banking, was in operation in ancient Babylon, and it's here again today, folks. It totally is here again today, okay? So, verse 26, and whereas they commanded to leave the stump of the tree roots, your kingdom shall be sure to you. After that, you shall have known that that the heavens do rule. Now, of course, he's talking to Nebuchadnezzar personally, that after his 7 years of madness, he will regain his senses, and his kingdom will be restored to him. But the same is true of Mystery Babylon, which after 2,520 years, namely seven times, their kingdom will be restored to them. Okay, verse 27. Wherefore, O king, let my counsel be acceptable to you, and break off your sins by righteousness. You're wasting your breath if you're telling this to a Jew. And your iniquities by showing mercy to the poor. But of course, Nebuchadnezzar was probably a white man. He was probably not a Jew. If it may be a lengthening of your tranquility. All this came upon the king Nebuchadnezzar. At the end of 12 months, he walked in the palace of the kingdom of Babylon. The king spoke and said, is not this great Babylon that I have built for the house of the kingdom by the might of my power and for the honor of my majesty? Verse 31. While the word was in the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven saying, O King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken, the kingdom is departed from you. Okay? So he personally now falls into this trance. Verse 32, and they shall drive you from men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. They shall make you to eat grass as oxen. And seven times, and now there's the fourth time we're told about these seven times, folks, shall pass over you until you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomsoever he will. Any comments up to this point, Bill?
Yeah, yes, I did, but I'm sorry, I got sidetracked.
Oh.
First, I'd like to talk about this Nebuchadnezzar.
Okay.
And that's the Daniel chapters 1 through 4, Nebuchadnezzar are definitely the same man. And it could only be Nebuchadnezzar 2, because he could only make that claim in Daniel 4:30.
Okay.
That he built Babylon.
Oh, okay.
Okay?
All right.
And Nabonidus also used the title Nebuchadnezzar. And we're going to see him in Daniel 5, but he did not build Babylon.
All right.
Nebuchadnezzar too. We know from the inscriptions that he was the builder of this magnificent city.
Okay, and the Bible does not make any distinction between Nebuchadnezzar 1 and 2.
No, and okay. If we look at Nebuchadnezzar 1 actually lived in the 12th century BC.
Okay,
between Nebuchadnezzar 2, 3, 4. No, it doesn't.
Wow, this is a good 600 years earlier.
Well, okay. Right, but Nebuchadnezzar 2 is the first Nebuchadnezzar of the Bible.
Right. Okay. Very good.
And it makes no no distinction,
right,
of Nabonidus, who is actually the Nebuchadnezzar of the time of Belshazzar in Daniel 5.
I see. Okay. All right, because I understand, that Nebuchadnezzar ruled for 40 years. If his rule began in 605 B.C., according to secular scholarship, then that would take us to 565 B.C., and Daniel, the Darius the Mede killed Belshazzar in 539 BC. So there had to be several rulers after 565 BC.
There were a couple of minor rulers, and Nabonidus actually supplanted a youthful successor of Nebuchadnezzar.
Okay, all right. Okay, so verse 33, the same hour was the thing fulfilled upon Nebuchadnezzar. And he was driven from men and did eat grass as oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven till his hairs were grown like eagle's feathers and his nails like bird's claws. Now, it's very interesting, till his hairs were grown like eagle's feathers. Isn't it true that once the mystery Babylon was reborn, it encompassed the world? For example, during the Napoleonic Wars, the Rothschilds had a system of couriers who could fly from one location to another and give them the latest information on who won what battle or how a battle was going or who needed how much money and how this loan was going, how that loan was going.
Actually, I think they used carrier pigeons.
Yes, they used carrier pigeons too. Yes, yes. And so their system of intelligence was far greater than the military couriers.
Well, that was the first Mossad, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
That's how they beat the banking game through good use of technology and knowledge. There's
right.
No doubt. They beat the Saxon bankers who would never. Most honest men don't think of those things
right
the way the Jews can make those contrivances.
Well, because they have agents in every country, whereas the Anglo-Saxons simply service the people of their own country.
Right.
And
the Rothschilds, actually, he sent his son out to every large, and
right,
all the large cities of Europe. He had son. If he had a son, he had a son for a city in Europe.
That's right. That's right.
I think he had five sons he started with that established banking branches of his family bank in five different cities.
Yes, he did. Yes. But the Jews have always been internationalists anyway, because they have taken up residence in every major city.
Well, they're a wandering Jew. They
That's
have no
right.
nation of their own.
But they always maintain contact with other Jews in other cities, and thereby always gain intelligence about other countries within their own community that the, you know, like Frenchmen wouldn't have about Germany, Germans wouldn't have about Britain, Britons wouldn't have about Russia, but the Jews have this information because they have their agents in every city in the world.
There's no doubt.
That's right.
They're borderless people, and that's why they want a world without borders.
Exactly.
And that's been their goal for 5,000 years.
And the
Kenite goal.
Right. And the average Christian or Anglo-Saxon Caucasian doesn't understand this, that the Jews have this system well established for thousands of years.
We just don't think along mercantile lines.
That's right. That's right.
It's just not natural to us, most of us.
And the word Canaanite, one of the definitions of Canaanite is merchant trafficker.
Well, yes, and that probably started out as a metaphor.
Right.
And ended up being a definition.
Exactly. That's what they are. They're merchant traffickers. That's what and bankers, okay? So this merchant trafficker business, banking, this is all Jewish from the get-go. You know, this doesn't describe our people. This doesn't describe Israel. This describes only the Jews, okay? So verse 34, and at the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up my eyes to heaven, and my understanding returned to me, and I blessed the Most High, and I praised and honored him that lives forever, whose dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation, which proves that he was a white man, otherwise he would not recognize Yahweh. And all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing, and he does according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and none can stay his hand or say to him, what do you? At the same time, my reason returned to me, and for the glory of my kingdom, my honor and brightness returned to me, and my counselors and my lord sought to me, and I was established in my kingdom, and excellent majesty was added to me. So the restoration of Nebuchadnezzar, the king, symbolizes the restoration of Mystery Babylon on planet Earth 2,520 years later, right? Isn't that what the symbolism is here?
Well, I believe so, yes.
Yeah.
And that happened after World War One or during that, during the World War One period.
Right. Well, let's see if I got my calculations here, because as I understand it, Nebuchadnezzar took Jerusalem in the year 607 B.C.
Well, 597, I think. He came and he may have had tribute from them before that.
Right.
He came in 11 years before the final downfall of Jerusalem, and Chronicles or Kings will time that, is when he took the 1,000 chief young men of Jerusalem back to Babylon.
Okay, all right.
And the temple implements or maybe were taken at that time also.
Okay. All right, well, yeah, 586 B.C. was the year of the final downfall of Jerusalem when the captives were taken to Babylon.
Yes, it was.
Okay. But the date that I have that Nebuchadnezzar, while Nabopolassar was still king, while his father Nabopolassar was still king, was 607 B.C. That's the date that I have that Nebuchadnezzar actually attacked and defeated Jerusalem, taking Daniel captive, and then he took him back to Babylon in the year 605 B.C., okay? But anyway, 607 B.C. plus 2,520 equals 1914, which is the beginning of World War One.
All right, but 586 B.C. plus 2,520 is 1933. That's the year that the Jews declared war on Judah.
Okay.
On Germany.
On Germany, yeah.
Well, I made the mistake on purpose.
Right, exactly. So, but maybe next time I can go into the dates that I have. We can, maybe before the show, we can compare our dates and see which is more correct, okay? Because some of these dates, depending on different scholars, they will give different dates for these events. In any case,
I can't arrive at an end time date. And I know that, so of these dates are just a distraction for me. I really don't keep track of them very well.
Right.
I'm going to be honest with you.
Okay. So maybe next time I'll have a complete set of dates with the correspondences of the seven times for each date, okay? And we can go over that before the show. But let's continue here. Verse 37. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of Heaven, all whose works are truth, and his ways judgment, and those that walk in pride he is able to humble or abase. Okay, verse I'm sorry, chapter 5, verse 1. Now here, we're talking a tremendous leap forward in time, because Nebuchadnezzar, you know, was certainly around 600 B.C., and he reigned for 40 years. And now, chapter 5, we're talking about Belshazzar, which is probably more in the time of 540 B.C., okay? And I don't know how long Belshazzar actually reigned.
Well, chapter 5, the events in chapter 5 had to take place in 539 B.C.
539 B.C.,
because
okay,
that's the year that Cyrus took Babylon.
Right.
And that's the night that Belshazzar died, is evidently when that happened.
Right. So there's a tremendous gap in time between chapters 4 and 5.
There might be a 17, 18-year gap at least,
yeah,
between 4 and 5.
Okay, but so we can't consider this to be perfectly chronological, all right? So Belshazzar, the king, made a great feast to 1,000 of his lords and drank wine before the 1,000. Belshazzar, while he tasted the wine, commanded to bring the golden and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem, that the king and his princes, his wives, his concubines might drink therein. Now, isn't there a problem here for Belshazzar calling Nebuchadnezzar his father? Would that be
Yeah, right, because his father was Nabonidus.
Okay.
And his father's not dead yet, all right? So
right,
his real natural father.
Right.
But often in Hebrew, father is used of a grandfather or a great-grandfather.
Too. Right. Right.
Now all I'd like to say is that all of the secular sources do not see, I'm not saying that they say there is none, but on some of them say it's there's not, but they really can't say there is none, because nobody knows who his mother is. Nobody knows who his grandmother is. There's a lot of things in this history we just don't know.
Okay.
But the secular sources say that Nabonidus really had no relation to any royal line.
Okay.
That he was a priest, and he actually did usurp the throne from the legitimate successor of Nebuchadnezzar.
Okay, I see.
Now, I don't think Daniel is using the term in the sense of forerunner, but it might be true that this Belshazzar actually did descend from Nebuchadnezzar. I mean, he's being called his father.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So there's quite
a but it is problematical. And it's problematical because we don't have enough information.
Well, so in terms of possibly being grandfather is what, because the Bible doesn't
grandfather count. Or great-grandfather even, because Nebuchadnezzar lived a long time.
Right. The Bible
he reigned for like 38 years or something like that.
Right. The Bible doesn't have these terms that we have today, like grandfather, grandmother, great-grandfather,
right,
cousin, nephew, uncle. It doesn't use those terms. Okay, certainly not in the Old Testament, okay?
No, your cousins are your kindred.
Right.
And that's why we get confused with, that's why Judeo-Christianity is so successful at confusing people with the meanings of terms.
Mm-hmm.
Because they didn't have cousin in the Bible, they used kinsman.
Mm-hmm.
And because they didn't have cousin in the Bible, often they used brethren.
Right.
I mean, my first cousin, as long as my uncle did the right thing with choosing a wife.
Right.
My first cousin would be as good as my brother.
That's right. He's
as close in blood as a half-brother.
Yes. Yes.
So he would be considered my brother. They didn't really have those terms.
Right.
In the Old Testament, they didn't have anything like
well,
that.
Well, because they were very race-conscious, and all they were really concerned about was that your brethren were of the same race as you were.
Right, and as long as we're of the same race, we're all brethren. That's the
right
point.
Exactly. Exactly.
And the Bible had loose terms for I shouldn't say the Bible. The ancient Hebrew language had loose terms for a female relative, a male relative.
Sure.
And the same word could have 5-6 different meanings in English.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So they were mainly concerned about the fact that your brethren were of the same race and tribe, and not their filial brother, sister, aunt, uncle relationship. They didn't think that way in those days.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Now, it would be about 58 years later that these vessels were taken out of the temple.
Okay. Okay.
It's
a long
time. Until this time. Yeah, it's a long time.
Yeah, okay. So they were stored away until this time. Verse 3, then they brought the golden vessels that were taken out of the temple of the house of God, which was at Jerusalem, and the king and his princes, his wives, his concubines drank in them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, of brass, of iron, of wood, and of stone. And hour came forth fingers of a man's hand and wrote opposite the candlestick upon the plaster of the wall of the king's palace, and the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. Then the king's countenance was changed, and his thoughts troubled him, so that the joints of his loins were loosed, and his knees smote. His knees were shaking. Okay, that's what it's saying here. His knees were shaking. He was so scared. Verse 7, the king cried aloud to bring in the astrologers and the Chaldeans and the soothsayers, and the king spoke and said to the wise men of Babylon, whosoever shall read this writing and show me the interpretation thereof shall be clothed with scarlet and have a chain of gold about his neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. Then came in all the king's wise men, but they could not read the writing nor make known the king the interpretation thereof.
Now, I have one quick statement.
Okay.
That third ruler of the kingdom shows that Belshazzar is actually the co-regent with his father Nabonidus at this time.
Okay.
Still.
Okay.
And this is what secular history also says.
Mm-hmm.
That Nabonidus was out to battle when Babylon fell to the Persians.
I see. Okay.
He had an army in the field, and he left his co-regent's son, home in Babylon to control the kingdom.
Right, and to guard the city.
And so he's thrown himself a big party here. And
yes.
And he wants to make, he wants to make the interpreter of the dream the third ruler, because he can't make him the second ruler. He's the second ruler. That's my point.
Right. Okay. All right. Very good. Okay. So verse 9, then was King Belshazzar greatly troubled, and his countenance was changed in him, and his lords were astonished. Now the queen, by reason of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banquet house, and the queen spoke and said, O king, live forever. Let not your thoughts trouble you, nor let your countenance be changed. There is a man in your kingdom, in whom is the spirit of the holy gods, and in the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, was found in him, whom the king Nebuchadnezzar, your father, the king, I say, your father, made master of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers. So is it possible that Belshazzar isn't familiar with Daniel here? Is it possible? Maybe it is.
Well, only in the sense that Daniel would be a much older man.
Okay.
And possibly Nabonidus. You see, Nabonidus, Belshazzar's father, he was big into the worship of the moon god Sin.
Okay.
And his goal, for some strange reason, was to establish many temples to this moon god Sin.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Now, Clifton Emmerheiser had actually done a big series on that very topic about the Nabonidus and his pushing this moon god
mm-hmm.
worship over the Marduk and
right.
Bel and the sun god worship of the Assyrians.
Yes, yes.
And Clifton uses that to elucidate that Nabonidus was a Kenite.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know if that's – reading Daniel, I don't know if I can really
– Yeah, go with that. Okay.
If I can go with it. But Clifton did a good job to present the argument. I'm not going to say he didn't.
Right.
But I'm just reading Daniel. I don't know if I really want to go with it. I'd have to give it a lot more study.
But that,
and I don't think that study can be arrived at.
But that would be a good explanation why Daniel was driven in the background.
Well, right. And that's what I'm going to try to say, is that because Nabonidus was a big moon god worshiper, somebody like Daniel would be marginalized.
Yes. Yes, he would be. And he'd probably just stay quiet and, not make trouble. If you got Nabonidus.
Right. And I'll only say one thing, that Belshazzar's name is related to the idol Bel.
Right, exactly.
So maybe Nabonidus wasn't like that his whole life.
Mm.
If he named his son after Bel.
Right.
And, otherwise his name should be Sinshazzar or something.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Okay, very good. So verse 12 then, for as much as an excellent spirit and knowledge and understanding interpreting of dreams, and showing of hard sentences and dissolving of doubts were found in the same Daniel, with whom the king named Belteshazzar, now let Daniel be called, and he will show the interpretation. Then was Daniel brought in before the king, and the king spoke and said to Daniel, are you that Daniel which are of the children of the captivity of Judah? That's the correct translation there, folks, of Judah. But then in the very next phrase, whom the king, my fathers, brought out of Jewry. Okay.
Yeah, that's just sickening that they translated it that way. But
right. It should be Judah in both cases. There's no reason to change Judah to Jewry. None whatsoever.
No, except to placate the Jews and
right.
curry their favor, which they were doing in the 1600s.
Exactly.
And British Israel is still doing it.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Verse 14, I have heard of you that the spirit of the gods is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom is found in you. And now the wise men, the astrologers, have been brought in before me that they should read this writing and make known to me the interpretation thereof. But they could not show the interpretation of the thing. And I have heard of you that you can make interpretations and dissolve doubts. Now if you can read the writing and make known to me the interpretation thereof, you shall be clothed with scarlet and have a chain of gold about your neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. Okay?
Now this shows that at this time, you know, you had to be of high royal office to even wear scarlet.
Right.
And I just wanted to mention that.
Yeah. And here in my King James Version, it does refer to Nabonidus as the father of Belshazzar in a footnote here. Okay.
Yeah.
So confirming what you've been saying. Verse 17. Then Daniel answered and said before the king, let your gifts be to yourself and give your rewards to another.
So Daniel basically just told him to stuff it.
Yeah. Right.
And that's, you know, he accepted the gratitude in Nebuchadnezzar too.
Yes.
But he's not accepting the gratitude of Belshazzar.
Yeah, well, he's saying, keep it, I don't need it, okay? Give your rewards to another. Yet I will read the thing that you want and make known to him the interpretation. O you, king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your father, a kingdom and majesty and glory and honor. And for the majesty that he gave him, all people, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him, who he would slay and whom he would have kept alive, and whom he would set up, and whom he would put down. But when his heart was lifted up, that is, when it became vain, and his mind hardened with pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him. And he was driven from the sons of men, and his heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling was with the wild asses, and they fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till he knew that the Most High God ruled in the kingdom of men, and that he appoints over it whomsoever he will. And you, his son, O Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this. Okay, well, he did know all of that. Verse 23, but have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven, and they have brought the vessels of his house before you, and you and your lords, your wives and your concubines, have drunk wine in them, and you have praised the gods of silver and gold and brass and iron, wood and stone, which see not, nor hear, nor know, and the God in whose hand your breath is, and whose are all your ways, you have not glorified. In other words, he's telling me he's a pagan. He's a pagan, and the true God does not care for what he's doing with these vessels of gold and silver. Verse 24. Then was the part of the land sent from him, and this writing was written. What is this? What is verse 24?
That was the part of the hand.
The hand.
The part of the right. hand. The whatever the hand had written was.
Yes.
Sent to him, basically.
Okay, then was the part of the hand sent from him, and this writing was written, and this is the writing that was written, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. Okay, so before we go into the interpretation, what's your thoughts here on these Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin?
Then the hand was sent from him,
yes.
or then, therefore, from his presence, has been a hand sent forth, the knuckle, the Septuagint is all screwed up here. I don't even want to read it anymore.
Okay. So the Septuagint is worse in this case.
Mene is an ancient, I want to talk a minute just about this word.
Yes.
Mene is the word that we have money from.
Okay.
And Mene is actually the word that became mina in the Bible that was M-N-A in Greek, mina or mina. Which the Romans in Latin had it as a measurement of money called mina. And the Romans also had a word moneta from the Hebrew word, which is mona, which
monetary.
Means something weighed out.
Uh-huh.
Okay? And mona became our word money.
Right.
So what I'm saying is that even our word for money can be traced back to ancient Babylon.
Right.
That's all I wanted to say.
Yeah, very interesting. Very interesting.
I don't know if you want me to to talk about the details, but a minor is generally 50 shekels.
Okay.
And it, sometimes it was 60 shekels.
Mm-hmm.
And as we spoke about before, that you told me that and it's right that a mina is 1,000 gerah.
That's right.
Mentioned it at Ezekiel 45.
Right.
But I was looking at Ezekiel 45, and you know they have a couple of definitions, and I'm going to find it right now.
Okay.
I want to bring this up because I know you're about to get to this.
Right.
Ezekiel 45:12. It says in the King James Version of the Bible that 20 gerahs is a shekel, and that means that 1,000 gerahs are in a mina, and that 5 and 20 shekels, and then comma, 15 shekels shall be your mana, which is a mina.
Right.
That, now, in the Septuagint, it says that 50 shekels will be a mina.
Right.
It's very different from the way this...
Huh, okay.
Okay, and I just want to let you know that because we discussed that. It says 5 shekels, 15 shekels, and 50 shekels shall be your mina, basically.
Right, right.
Okay. In other words, there were three measurements all considered a mina for some reason.
Right, they had various depending on the, there was a royal mina, there were three different kinds. However, the ones that, let me quote here from Howard B. Rand studying Daniel, because what I'm getting to here is that this is not just a handwriting on the wall, but potentially a prophecy that relates to 2,520, okay? And here's what he says on page 153, and this is his book, Studying Daniel. The 1,000 gerah equal one gold mina. The value, then, in the weight of the sum of the inscription in gerahs would be as follows. Aramaic, mene, M-E-N-E, Hebrew, mina, M-I-N-A, 1,000 gerahs. Again, we have another mina, another 1,000 gerahs. Tekel or shekel means 20, and an uparshin perez means a division or half a mina, which is 500. So the total is 2,520, suggesting to us that this date, when Babylon fell, 539 B.C., that there's also a seven times prophecy related to that date as well. And that's the only reason I'm bringing it up, okay?
Well, there's an alternate interpretation of Upharsin. However, that it seems to be that you had the correct one there.
Okay. And so we'll find out whether or not, you know, that there is a relationship.
Simply because so many other 2520s show up in the Bible.
Right, yeah.
But the only caveat I would like to give is that 2520 years from the time that Babylon fell is actually 1981.
Okay, right. Actually, 1982.
Okay.
You have to add for the fact that there's no year zero. Okay. So that would be 1982. Okay, so... And the only thing that I can think of that happened, and I looked in the history books to see if anything significant happened that year, and the only thing I can find is the fact that Ron Wyatt discovered the blood on the mercy seat that year. I can't find any other significant factor. So nothing, what's his name, Ariel Sharon killed those 2,000 defenseless
Well, I don't think anything the Jews do or anything that happens to the Arabs is going to be really pertinent to the fall of Babylon or the children of Yahweh.
Right.
Real children of Yahweh.
Yeah. So the only thing I've been able to find of any significance is Ron Wyatt's discovery of the Ark of the Covenant under the Mount Golgotha in 1982. But let's continue here. Verse 26. This is the interpretation of the thing. Mene, God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. Tekel, you are weighed in the balances and are found wanting. Peres, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians.
Okay. Now, I would only like to say that Daniel interprets both tekel and peres here as verbs.
Okay.
However, those words, it doesn't... pull the interpretation you just presented apart,
mm-hmm.
because those words are also nouns.
Right.
And the Hebrew words, if you look at the Hebrew words without the vowel points that the Masoretes added in to assist them in reading the words.
Right.
The original Hebrew words had no vowel points, and the nouns were indistinguishable from the verbs.
Yes.
And
yes.
In many cases, you had words spelled the same in the noun and the verb form.
Yes.
And only the context could allow you to interpret it.
Right, right, yeah. And then the King James translators, I'm sure, had difficulty with that as well, okay? No doubt. All right, so verse 29, then commanded Belshazzar, and they clothed Daniel with scarlet and put a chain of gold about his neck and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler of the kingdom. Now, I find this fascinating that basically he told Belshazzar, well, your kingdom is going to fall. But he couldn't possibly have understood what he really meant here. Okay, you're weighed in the balances and found wanting. And the fact that Belshazzar would even accept this interpretation is sort of interesting.
Well, it may have alleviated his trouble, and he knew what to expect.
Yeah, it could be. It could be. It just satisfied him. After all, he was drunk, right?
but these people were highly they were highly superstitious, the pagans.
Right.
And they would definitely be know that they couldn't avoid their fate one way or the other. So they may as well be happy about it.
Let's get back to partying. Bring out the robes and the gold. All right. So anyway, verse 29, then commanded Belshazzar, and they clothed Daniel with scarlet and put a chain of gold about his neck and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom, which is pretty impressive. You're the third highest ranking official in the nation. Again, because the same thing happened to him under Nebuchadnezzar.
Now, and I have a problem with verse 31.
Okay, well, let me read verse 31 to 32 then real quick. In that night was Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, slain, and Darius the Median took the kingdom, being about 62 years old.
Well, it's not really a problem, but, the Greeks used titles that stuck to the names of Persian rulers.
Okay.
Who had their own names, but in the Greek writing, you never saw the name.
Uh-huh.
In other words, Xerxes is really a nickname.
Okay.
And Artaxerxes is a nickname. They mean warrior and great warrior,
uh-huh.
It's generally perceived.
Okay.
Now, they actually named this king, who had his own Persian name. It's not in my head. He's one of the Achaemenid kings. And the Greeks named him Xerxes.
Uh-huh.
So in all Greek writing, he became Xerxes.
Okay.
And the Greeks named Artaxerxes Artaxerxes, and Artaxerxes is actually a corruption, it seems, of the title Ahasuerus, which appears in several different variations in both Aramaic and Greek, and in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah and even here and here in the Septuagint, it doesn't say Darius, it says Ahasuerus, but these are all titles,
right?
And the Greeks, Darius it's probably Darius the Mede did not take the kingdom. Cyrus took the kingdom, but evidently this is a Cyrus isn't his real name either. But evidently this is a title for Cyrus, who would be called Cyrus the Mede because his mother was a Mede.
Okay. Yeah.
So he could be called the Mede or just as well the Persian. It didn't
matter. Right. Right. There's just an interesting bit of history before proceeding to chapter 6. Again, this is from Howard B. Rand's book, Study in Daniel, talking about how Babylon actually fell. And it's very interesting because Babylon was a huge city. And the Medes and Persians had compassed the city about trying to figure out how to get into the walls, okay, and attack the Babylonians, and the Babylonians had no even inkling that there was any way for them to bridge get over the walls or break down the gates or anything. So they were not even concerned about the fact that the army was outside the walls, okay? And so they were just partying. So but here is from the book History of the World by Ridpath, R-I-D-P-A-T-H.
Yeah, the place to read this story is Herodotus, but that's all right. I'll let you read it from Ridpath.
Okay, all right.
I don't have it in front of me from Herodotus, but I know the story.
Uh-huh. Okay, anyway, it goes like this. He therefore resorted to an audacious experiment, meaning Cyrus, which was planned and executed with entire success. Leaving a portion of his troops to occupy the attention of the Babylonians before the city walls, he withdrew with the remainder to a safe distance up the river, and there, having marked the topography of the country, undertook the work of dispersing a large part of the waters of the Euphrates from the natural bed into canals, which he had cut for the purpose. When the work was done and everything was in readiness to dissipate the river, Cyrus still delayed. He had learned that the great annual festival of the Babylonians was about to be celebrated, and he awaited the coming of that event as the best time to strike the impending blow. Meanwhile, the Babylonians, in contempt of an enemy whom they supposed to be foiled in this purpose, made unusual preparations for the great feast. The young prince Belshazzar gave himself up recklessly to the occasion. 1,000 nobles were invited to the royal banquet at the palace. There was splendor without, within, and darkness without. It was the night of doom. While the revel was going on in the wild abandon of the victorious debauchery, the hardy Persian was opening the sluices to his canals above the city. The river began to sink, but made no moan or no noise, I guess he means. The invaders hurried along the banks to the wall of the city. There was no alarm. The river had left on either side a broad space of bare ground. The Persians passed in without opposition. The noise of the festival resounded far. The river gates were seized by the invaders, who now sounded the tocsin and began the assault. It was a gigantic massacre. So in other words, what they did was they diverted the river Euphrates, and so I guess it passed under the city walls at a level where no one could possibly swim in. But by sinking the level of the river, they were able to get their army in and started massacring a bunch of drunken revelers. Okay. And that's how the Medes and Persians got into the city and conquered the city of Babylon.
Well, right. They diverted, according to Herodotus, they diverted the river, and according to Xenophon.
Uh-huh.
And Herodotus wrote about 100 years after the fact.
Right.
And
right.
Xenophon's writing about 150 years, perhaps,
yes,
after the fact.
Right, right.
So they both have a, they both, actually, Xenophon was in Babylon, personally,
uh-huh,
on the March of the 10,000, which is recorded in his book Anabasis.
Yes.
He actually went to Babylon at one time as a mercenary. And had to flee along with his 10,000 Greek fellows.
Uh-huh, okay.
And that was a famous story. Xenophon was actually elected one of their leaders.
Right, right.
A general.
Okay.
So they both record this story. But whether or not there was an actual battle is disputed.
Mm-hmm.
And Herodotus doesn't really mention a battle, I don't think. He only says that the river was diverted,
yeah,
and they ended up opening the gates of the city to them because they were in it.
Right, yeah.
It was like, okay, we give up, you know?
Yeah, but if everybody was partying, then they weren't ready. If the Babylonians were all partying, then they weren't ready for a battle. And
well, I believe that that there's a prophecy that says that the gates of the city would simply be open to them.
Uh-huh, okay, interesting.
And I would have to I actually didn't even think of it before the program.
Right. Oh, okay.
But it's in Isaiah 45.
Uh-huh. Oh, okay.
It's in Isaiah 45. And I will loose the loins of kings to open before him the two-leaved gates. And the gate shall not be shut.
Uh-huh. Okay, very good. Yeah. So they were able to sneak a band of soldiers into the city by lowering the level of the Euphrates River, and then they opened the gates and let the rest of the army in.
Right, and Isaiah 45 seems to be a suggestion that the gates would just be open to Cyrus.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, he evidently had to divert the river to get that to happen, but that, you know, Herodotus wrote about the majesty of Babylon's walls.
Mm-hmm.
And Babylon was circled by more than one set of walls.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been a very, very difficult city to hold under siege.
Right.
Think about diverting the river.
Right.
And the walls of Babylon crossed the Euphrates.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So Babylon was a great harbor city. You see, at this time, the mouth of the Persian Gulf was not where it is. It was much, it was up near, in the vicinity of ancient Babylon.
Okay.
Okay? But because of all the sand and silting, eventually the harbor at Babylon became silted over and unnavigable. And that's probably why the city fell into disuse.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah. So it was no longer a harbor.
Right. And the actual mouth of the Persian Gulf is many miles from where it was 2,000 years ago.
A couple hundred miles at least, I think.
Yeah. It's very far.
Yeah.
The city was, the river up near the city was supposedly a great harbor and much more navigable when the city was built.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, I see that we only have less than 10 minutes left, so maybe we should just postpone going into Chapter 6. Somebody in the chat had said something about the Medes and Persians not being white.
The Medes and the Persians were absolutely white. They were probably, they wouldn't be out of place anywhere in this country today as white people.
Uh-huh.
And it's absolutely nuts to think that, that's an absolute ignorant statement. I'm sorry.
Right.
There's no excuse for it. Go read a history book.
Oh, okay. I'm seeing, he says, don't you know that the Egyptians are a black race? Where'd the Greeks learn to read and write from except, okay, this guy's a lurker. Okay. So supposedly the Egyptians were black also. Now, of course, we know that all the mummies of the ancient pharaohs are white.
They're all white. I got a whole page on Christogenia of Egyptian pharaohs.
Uh-huh.
They're all absolutely white. I can prove it just by saying two words.
Right.
Nose bridge.
Right. Okay.
Go look at the pictures.
Yeah. And if they were... If they were blacks, how did they forget how to read and write?
Yeah. I've actually had blacks that believed in that. It's called Afrocentrism.
Right.
That all ancient learning actually came from a black Egypt.
Right.
And Harvard, they actually had departments for this in Harvard and Yale.
Mm-hmm. You got it.
The Jews love this stuff because it kicks the pillars out from under white civilization.
Yes.
So the Jews love to push this Afrocentrism thing.
Well, yeah.
And I've met proponents of this Afrocentrism that have told me that the Greeks got their alphabet from black Egypt and they got their mathematical learning from black Egypt.
Yeah.
And I asked them how they didn't have an alphabet now.
Right.
And he stood there dead serious and looked at me and said, because you stole it from
them.
How do you steal an alphabet?
Right. How do you steal language? How do you steal a wheel?
They're absolutely ignorant. They have, like, the average black IQ is, like, 75 or 80.
Uh-huh.
And they believe this stuff when they're taught it.
Right. Yeah, it's absolutely crazy. Well, so here, you know, that goes along with the myth. And this is, you know, the lack of historicity of the Judeo-Christian churches. The fact that they can actually teach this nonsense that Ham was black, Shem was white, and Japheth was Oriental. I mean, where does this stuff come from? It's absolutely absurd. I mean, they're just making stuff out of thin air.
That's what they do.
Yeah.
And you know, if I slept with my wife and had Shem and he was a white kid, I'd think that was good.
Right,
And if I slept with her again and had Japheth and he was Chinese, there ain't going to be no Ham.
Right.
It ain't happening.
Right.
I'm not sleeping with her a third time.
Right.
It's just not going on.
Right. But, you know, and throughout the history of black Africa, with all the missionaries and the, sojourners, you know, the safaris, et cetera, the travelers, they never found a white person there. There's no possibility that two black people can make a white person or vice versa. It never happened at any time in history, you know. Same with Europe. The European experience, there weren't any black people in Europe.
A guy that believed that a black baby was his would have to be a real sucker.
Right.
For his wife to say, honey, I swear it's yours.
That's right. So the only time we have mixed race babies coming from people is during the modern era of race mixing. It never happened before. There was never a time in European history before, you know, black Africans were imported as slaves, that two white people had a non-white child. That's all there is to it. And there was never a time in African history before the white man came down there that two blacks they never had anything but black children. That's all there is to it, you know. Anything else is mythology.
The problem with Ham is that his descendants became black, for the most part.
Well, they married into, yeah.
The Ethiopians and the Egyptians started taking Nubians as slaves. Eventually, they started Nubian harems.
Okay.
After they started Nubian harems, it's common knowledge, the pharaohs had Nubian harems.
Yes.
In southern Egypt. And once that started, you can't keep the commoners from
right.
from doing what they want. And it's just more and more of that blood seeped into Egypt and Ethiopia until the Nubians rose up and overran them.
Right, exactly.
And the Nubians overran all of Ethiopia and turned it black. And they overran all of Egypt. And the history of Ethiopia is a little more remote, but we know for sure the history of Egypt. In the 8th century, Nubians, black Africans ruled Egypt and sat in the pharaoh's seat for 50, 60 years.
Right, right.
And the blood never left Egypt.
Right.
The later glorious Egypt was Greek. The Egypt of the Ptolemies was not one bit Egyptian.
Right.
It was all Greek.
Yes, yes. So the history of the great periods of Egypt are when the white man ruled. Okay. And when the white man did not rule, it was in a period of decline. That's the long and the short of it. Yeah, yeah. Now, it's interesting, though, that the Ethiopians, if you look at the modern Ethiopians, who are blacks, okay, they have their features are much more white than, you know, further south and further west in Africa, okay? So they're, and they have retained what they call the Ethiopian, they call themselves the Ethiopian Jews.
Yes.
They have retained a version of the Bible, which is non-Talmudic, which they claim is older than the Talmud, and I believe them, that because our people...
Well, that's a little different, that story.
Okay.
And that's, you know, the actual Ethiopians, the original Kushites in Ethiopia were white.
Yes.
There's
the
no
original
doubt.
Ones, yes.
However, the Judaism or Hebrewism is more appropriate.
Yes.
In the 6th century B.C., Cambyses, and actually, after he took Egypt, they had hired men from Judah, and Cambyses probably had men from Judah in his army anyway.
Yes.
They had people from, now whether they were men from Judah, from Babylon, or from Jerusalem is immaterial.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to be they were probably from Babylon. Okay?
Yeah.
They had planted a fortress and a cadre of those men on Elephantine. And they were mercenaries working for the Persian king who were guarding Elephantine, was considered the southern outpost of the Egyptian, of the empire.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Yeah. And it was an island in the middle of the Nile. And Elephantine, they actually wrote back for permission to build a model of the temple there so that they could worship.
Right.
And the authorities in Jerusalem told them to get lost, basically.
Yeah, but only Israelites would have had even made such a request.
Well, right, absolutely.
Yeah.
And this knowledge comes to us through the Elephantine papyri.
Okay.
Which are a collection of writings that were kind of found by accident that and held by a private person for a long time before they were published.
Mm-hmm.
And they're actually the papyri are authentic, there's no doubt.
Yeah.
And they actually tell this story about, you know, they contain parts of the letters of these people seeking to build this temple because they wanted to worship after the manner of their fathers and they couldn't get to Jerusalem, blah, 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 blah,
mm-hmm.
blah. And I believe that's where that whole tradition with these Falasha Jews, they call these Ethiopian Jews, that these people at Elephantine eventually mingled in with the local populace.
That's right. That's right.
And passed down their I don't know if I want to call it Hebrewism, Judaism, or what.
Whatever, mixed, yeah. But there were definitely white people that mixed in with the Ethiopians, the native Ethiopians, who were blacks, okay? But you can see from their faces and from their cranial structure, et cetera, that they have a lot of white in them, much more so than the rest of black Africa. Okay?
Right, they're definitely a mixed race.
That's right.
They're not
Yeah, and Haile Selassie, you look at him versus, you know, an African from, you know, Central Africa, he's got a lot of white in him, you know.
Right.
Maybe
and
not
it's
a whole
shame,
lot,
but it's a shame, but it's a fact of history.
Right. But that just proves what we're saying, that namely those areas were white, And then they slowly but surely became mixed. And, you know, by today, obviously, they're no longer white at all. And,
well, if you read Diodorus Siculus's third book of his Library of History, you'll see that he talks about an Ethiopia with a Western tradition.
Mm-hmm.
They quote Homer and reference to themselves and all kinds of things he says about these Ethiopians. And then he talks about these savage tribes in the area, and he
yes.
doesn't call them Ethiopians.
Right.
He calls them, he names them basically after what the Greeks thought they ate.
Okay. All right.
So he calls them lotus eaters and fish eaters and elephant eaters
uh-huh.
and or whatever that the Greeks thought they ate.
Yes.
And flower eaters. And they basically have black woolly hair and they're savages.
Okay, yes.
And Diodorus Siculus draws this portrait of African Ethiopia
yeah.
that shows that there's I'm not going to say a white, okay,
mm-hmm.
because Diodorus Siculus doesn't call them white.
Mm-hmm.
But they're evidently white because they have Western traditions. Some of them were educated in Greece, that they have copies of the classics, that they're a civilized people.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a sharp distinction between them and the ones Diodorus Siculus
right.
does call black and woolly-headed.
Yes.
And he doesn't refer to the civilized ones as black and woolly-headed.
Okay, yeah.
And that's book three of Library of History.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And it's like 20, 30 chapters. It's a whole long spiel.
Yeah, the mummies, the wall drawings, the history that you're talking about, and the fact of what we know about the Bible and the nations of Genesis 10, that they were all white. There's no other way. There's no possibility they could have been anything else but white. And they spread around the entire area from the north of Mesopotamia up into what's now called Scythia, you know, what we call Scythia. All the way down to Egypt, and in fact, even into India. That's
well. I really think that the Ethiopia south of Egypt is called Kush,
mm-hmm.
and Mesopotamia under the first Babylonian Empire was called Kush.
Right,
and
right.
that's where Moses got his wife from.
Yes, yes.
Now the I believe, and it's conjecture, but it's the only story that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Is that part of Africa was colonized by Kushites by sea?
Yes. Yes,
because it's right across the water.
Right,
it's an easy trip by water.
Right, right, and the populations were growing, and they had to expand. You know, that's the natural explanation.
Well, they were always in search, especially in Mesopotamia, where there's the Fertile Crescent.
Yeah,
can only support so many millions of people.
Right,
and the Greeks and the Hebrews and those people were always looking for more. Arable land,
right.
and that's an underlying thread throughout all of the classics.
Right,
all of the Athenian colonies and the Spartan colonies, they were all in search of arable land.
Yeah, yeah, and
that's actually drove settlement and the push towards the west.
Yeah, and Central Arabia was probably not as dry in those days, but it was still drier than the rest than the Fertile Crescent.
Well, so, absolutely, but yeah. you know, it's pretty obvious right from the Bible that Egypt supported at one time. Huge flocks
mm-hmm.
that it couldn't support today.
Right, right, yeah. And the same is true in Palestine, too. You know, the area was not as arid then as it is today.
And the cedar forest of Lebanon,
if you
read in the Epic of Gilgamesh, that is described as literally miles and miles and miles of cedar trees all the way to the sea.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
and that must have been some huge
forest,
cedar forest at one time.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Okay, very good. So that takes us to the end of Daniel chapter 5. We will pick up next time, ladies and gentlemen, with chapter 6 tomorrow. Just a reminder, Yahweh's covenant people will continue in the book of Acts, and then Sunday we'll be talking about what really went on at Fort Hood, and also we'll be talking about Mormonism, how Mormonism has really changed over the years, and what's wrong with the Mormon Church today, okay? So that'll be the subject for Sunday. And then, Bill, you've got a couple other shows this weekend as well?
We have Yahweh's Covenant People and Acts chapter 20 tomorrow.
Right.
And I have the with Sword Brethren at 9 p.m.
Sunday.
On Sunday, I have Germany and the Jewish Problem, part 3.
Okay.
corruption and immorality amongst the Jews and everything. And I'm going to actually draw a lot of parallels with 50s and 60s America.
Okay, very good. All right, so ladies and gentlemen, thanks for listening. This is Pastor Eli James and William Fink. We'll be back with you tomorrow night with Yahweh's Covenant People. It's been a fun show, and we'll resume Daniel next Friday. So in the meantime, Yahweh bless everybody.
Praise Yahweh.
Praise Yahweh.
Thanks.